You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Good morning, and thanks for joining us for this special post-election episode of the City of Man podcast. If you are new to the show, the City of Man is a conversation between two evangelical political theorists, a conservative and a progressive, about political philosophy and the politics of the day. I am Edward Song, and I am an associate professor of philosophy at Westmont College in Santa Barbara, California.
And I am Coyle Neal, an assistant professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri.
Coyle and I are recording this episode on Wednesday morning, the day after a stunning historic presidential election. In 2 months' time, Donald J. Trump will be inaugurated as the 45th president of the United States of America. For those who have been listening to our show over the past few months, you will know that neither Coyle nor myself were happy about Trump's nomination and potential presidency. As the resident progressive voice on the show, I have to say that last night was a difficult night in a lot of ways. And even while I have experienced the loss of my preferred candidate in the past, I haven't quite experienced the range of emotions that I experienced last night. Coyle, you and I purposely haven't talked at all since the election. I'm dying to know what you are thinking when you hear the words President Trump.
So surprise is probably the big one. This is obviously not something that any of the pollsters saw coming. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. I'm not entirely sure what I think about President Trump. We had a forum for students, sort of encouraging them to think well about how they vote and what sorts of characteristics they ought to be looking for in presidential candidates and so on. And then the question and answer sign, someone asked me and my colleague which of them would be the worst president, you know, of the two major candidates. I tried to answer, you know, Jill Stein, and that got shot down pretty quickly. So they were like, no, of the two major candidates, who's going to be the worst president? And my response was that I think Hillary Clinton will be a worse president for me personally, and that I think there would have been a direct intentional attack on institutions that I care very much about. So the school I teach at, the church I'm a member of, those sorts of things would have come under immediate fire. I don't think Donald Trump will do that. I don't think Donald Trump, even though he may agree with her on many of the policies where the policies that would be driving that institutional attack, I don't think Trump just cares enough about it to do anything. So in that sense, this is maybe sort of personally better, but I think he'll be much worse for the country. So I sort of have skin in both sides of that game, and I don't know which one I was sort of hoping for. I've heard this compared to, you know, a poker game. Like, someone played a queen, and we were, like, thinking, you know, this is going to win, and then the other side played a deuce, and it turned out that deuces were wild. So It's just nobody saw this coming, other than Donald Trump.
Yeah, I want to talk about that in a second. I am obviously surprised, but I have to say I'm not totally shocked, actually. And that was a position that I've worked to in the last couple weeks. But can I ask you, so you teach at Southwest Baptist University. It is a conservative Baptist school in the heartland, in a state that broke very hard for Donald Trump. You now have a Republican governor, my good friend Eric Greitens.
We do, which is also counter to the polls.
Yes. You also elected, after what looked like a very tight race, you re-elected your Republican senator.
And again, very tight, right up until the results started coming in, and then it was a landslide.
Yeah, and so I'm wondering what the mood, and you were at an election party, or as you called it, an end of the Republic party.
Right. Which is probably hyperbole. The Republic's been gone for a while, so, you know, nails in the coffin of the Republic party.
So I'm curious what the mood on campus was like last night when the results were coming in.
For better or worse, I don't know if this was necessarily the right way to go about it, but much of the mood on campus, we are a fairly pro-Trump school, although not as much as you might expect from a school like us. I think a lot of the support for Trump here was sort of what you've seen more across the Republican spectrum of kind of resignation of, I guess he's the candidate now, so we should support him.
So it wasn't necessarily sort of genuine, full-throated enthusiasm.
It was certainly more, we don't want this other person, right? Uh-huh. It was more anti-Hillary than pro-Trump. But, of course, on the night itself, it is still one has to win and one has to lose. Mm-hmm. But much of that was muted. We turned on CNN instead of Fox News. Mm-hmm. So we had, there's a TV in the room we were in, and then there was a TV in sort of a different room next door that was less comfortable and so on, that was turned to Fox News. So if you were sitting in the room where the food and the party was, you were watching CNN. If mm-hmm. you're sitting in the other room where there was no food and there weren't very many people, you were watching Fox News. I don't know if you were following this at all, but Fox was much more, they were much bolder in calling states for Trump. Not in ways that are necessarily unresponsible, given the polls and so on, but CNN was much more cautious in waiting to make sure that they had everything and they were within outside of the margin of error and so on.
Fox called Wisconsin. I mean, like it was more than an hour before CNN did.
Oh, and it was like it was an hour and a half or 2 hours before CNN called Florida after Fox had called it. Fox was, again, they weren't being irresponsible in terms of the numbers. it was fine. But I think, was what the students were focusing on. There was sort of that irritation with the media. So maybe there was other stuff going on. I obviously wasn't listening to everyone all the time. But that seemed to offset some of whatever else might have been said. At least that's the thing I heard most, this media bias discussion over, CNN versus Fox. I thought about flipping it over to MSNBC just to see if anyone, had a stroke on the spot. But I finally decided that wasn't a great idea.
And were the students, so I imagine people were surprised. Were they excited? Were they happy? Were they enthusiastic?
There was some enthusiasm. By the time it was announced that Trump had won, it was 11:30 or midnight, something like that. By the time it was clear he was going to win, I guess they didn't actually announce the victory until later in the morning. Most of the students had gotten home. But there was definitely, I don't think anyone really saw this coming other than the most optimistic of partisans who had been saying stuff like this all along and who, of course, I will admit that I had largely dismissed because they're optimistic partisans. Mm-hmm. Now, you're at a Christian college that I assume is somewhat conservative by virtue of being a Christian college. Do you have similar feelings for what's going on there?
We are a Protestant evangelical school.
Right.
I think in virtue of the tradition of the school and its location in Southern California and the kinds of students that we get, I think it's sort of a little bit obsessed with the trappings of cultural evangelical Christianity than other kinds of schools, and doesn't sort of labor under the kind of mantle that, like, say, Wheaton does. I'm teaching an intro philosophy class, and we were doing a unit in political philosophy, and just for fun, I kind of put together an impromptu poll, one of these online polls, and it broke. I can't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but they were decisively in favor of Donald Trump. I would say that it was sort of 40% Trump, something like 20-25% Clinton, and then fill out the rest of the ballot.
Yeah, we did something similar here, which our poll actually was a representative sample of the school. Mm-hmm. So we took a poll. Trump did not win the majority he needed to become president. But he did win, I mean, a vast majority of the votes, a vast plurality, I guess, of the votes. So he had more than everyone else put together. So it was, we had very, very similar results, I guess, to what you guys said.
Yeah, that's about what I found in my very unrepresentative sample of, like, a class of 40 kids.
Right.
Taking intro to philosophy. And I have to say that did kind of surprise me, and we didn't go any further to sort of analyze the roots of their support.
Oh, we did the whole thing. We did All of the intro classes took the poll. When there was no majority, we kicked it up to the House of Representatives, so we turned it over to the department. There are four of us, and to have a majority, of course, you have to have three votes. So we cast a ballot between the four of us and came up with a four-way tie. So we eliminated the...
Right?
Yeah, so we eliminated McMullen had been the lowest in the student vote. So we eliminated him, and then we held another ballot, and it came up with one for Clinton, one for Trump, and two for Johnson. So we held another ballot and had that two or three more times until finally one of us had to go to class. So the person who had to go to class switched their vote, and Gary Johnson was the president at our school as, you know, House of Representatives election.
And so what was going through your head last night when you saw the Clinton struggles first in Virginia and then in North Carolina and Florida?
You know, it was really when they hadn't called Pennsylvania right away. I think that was sort of when I was like, oh, something different is going on here. And then when Trump took the lead in Michigan and Wisconsin, the North Carolina and Florida, we knew those were battleground states, right? I mean, we knew it was going to be close there. It's the Rust Belt that was surprising here. Surprising to everyone but apparently Donald Trump and his campaign staff. Like, the idea that they were going to be able to flip Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania, which, I mean, I don't remember the exact dates, but they haven't gone Democrat since the 80s. I don't know if it was 84 or 88.
The last Democratic president Wisconsin voted for was Ronald Reagan's second term. You know, so they haven't voted for a Republican since 1984. They voted for Dukakis in 88.
So again, it's been more than 20 years. No, granted, both those states have Republican governors. And news came in fairly early that, what is his name? The senator from Wisconsin, right, didn't win his election.
Yeah.
Election bid. So again, those were signs that something different was going on. And again, that's just not, that was not reflected in the polls leading into it.
Mm-hmm. For my part, so I grew up in Virginia. I went to grad school in Virginia. I have lots of friends who are still in Virginia. And Virginia is an interesting state politically because, right. I mean, it's sort of recently flipped. And, you know, I remember watching the two Obama elections.
Mm-hmm. I was in Virginia for both of those, too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Virginia figured very large in both of those elections. And, in both of those elections, McCain first and then Romney, they were leading in Virginia. They were leading in Virginia until very, very late. And because the issue is in Virginia, the Northern Virginia, Washington, D.C. suburbs are very heavily Democratic. And it just takes them a long time to count the ballots. And so I was sort of like, you know, the news looked bad, but I kept on, and I had friends who were there who were all like, everybody relax, this is the way it always works, it always breaks late, it's just the way that it is. And so I was getting really tense, and then there were those crazy, the New York Times, I don't know if you saw their website, but they, their political quant page was sort of having, like, running percentages.
Yep. That's what I was
crazy, going. Yeah, crazy things. And I just kept on saying, it's going to be okay. It's going to break late. It always does. And eventually Virginia broke late. But then it was really clear that the margin she was getting in a state that was supposed to be a cakewalk for her, and where her running mate was the very popular governor and senator, the fact that she just eked that out, it was just clear that North Carolina was a lost cause. Florida was a lost cause.
Right.
Yeah, and then honestly, you were razzing me about this earlier, but like, I experienced emotions that I have never experienced in a presidential election before. I mean, I've certainly experienced disappointment, like when Gore lost in 2000, that was extremely disappointing. But felt sick to my stomach.
Well, and it's understandable that this will be more disappointing for the left because of the lead-in, where it looked like Hillary was in the lead so much. I mean, Trump, there have been one or two polls that he's been consistently in the lead of, but they are, I mean, I think it's like the LA Times poll has never had him behind.
Yeah.
But, I mean, those are the outliers. And, Yeah, and we'll talk a little bit about what happens to conventional wisdom, you know, as a result of this election. But I understand why this is going to be more crushing for the left than it will be even for folks like me on the right who still don't think much of Trump. Although I will say he gave an excellent concession speech.
Victory speech, you mean?
Victory speech.
Yes.
Despite forgetting Mike Pence when he was thanking people.
Yeah, and I think that's telling. I think he hates Mike Pence.
I don't know that he cares about Mike Pence at all.
I think he feels disrespected by him, and I don't think that was intentional. But it was telling that he thanked everybody since his kindergarten teacher.
Yeah.
And then after he said goodbye, he was like, "Oh, and Mike Pence. Thanks to Mike Pence." Yeah. So, I mean, for me, in the last 2 weeks, I was starting to get really stressed. And it was interesting because I was reading, been reading a couple things, but Huffington Post, Nate Silver's website, 538, that's what it's called, right? Has consistently shown the presidential election to be closer. I mean, he still had Clinton as a pretty prohibitive favorite, but her percentages of winnings was sort of in like the mid-60s. Whereas everybody else had her up in the 90s. And there was a Huffington Post article that was written by, like, their quant pollster person who was really sort of, was really critical of Silver, and he was like, Silver, because I think Silver had recently changed the algorithm, and he was taking Silver to task on that, and he's like, he's fudging the results, and he has these ulterior motives. And, but I have to say, I've been suspicious, and part of it was, I think I'd read something about the polling fluctuations in all of the polls. I mean, it's all of the polls since the conventions. And the thing about the fluctuations is that, like, people couldn't understand why they were fluctuating so much. But, I think Silver's line, and the line that I thought was right, is that the reason they fluctuated in concert with people's unwillingness to tell pollsters that they were supporting Trump.
Right.
And so when Trump was on the bandwagon and was tamed and wasn't saying outrageous things, people more willing to express their true feelings. And then you saw in all the polls it would narrow. And then every time he did something insane, or like when the video came out, people became very, very resistant to tell pollsters. But I think the nature of their support was such that while they might not have liked those embarrassing things, they weren't actually the kinds of things that were going to sway their opinion. Right?
Which is basically what happened in the last British election, right? I mean, you had all of the polls who had the, I forget which party, Labour or Liberal or whatever, like one of the left-wing parties. It's very popular and it's very the in thing to say that you are on the left wing of politics. And, if you're on the right wing, you have to sort of hide with your head in a bag under your bed. But when you get into that voting booth and there's no one else there, there's no pollster, there's no one judging you over your shoulder, you can vote however you want. And it turns out there were more people on the right than, anyone had imagined.
Yeah.
That's not surprising in some states like South Carolina. It is surprising in Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania.
Wisconsin. Iowa.
Even states like, to some extent, like Arizona. I mean, it's not a guaranteed Republican state. New Hampshire, for crying out loud, is not necessarily guaranteed, although I don't think they've called that yet. I think they're, which is surprising because they call Florida within, 2 or 3 hours. The next day, they're still counting New Hampshire. I mean, I know there's just one guy up there counting them by hand, but still.
With cataracts and...
Yeah.
When you look back at all of the pre-election polls post-convention, like, the accurate poll was whatever poll that had Trump's highest number, right? When people were most willing to actually express their truth.
It's that LA Times poll. I mean, and I know that they use different methodologies, and I haven't followed through on that. I haven't had time to follow through on it because I just sort of dismissed it as this weird outlier. And sure enough, other responses that you had, Ed. I'm sorry, I sort of jumped in on you there.
No. So I mean, I guess a lot of people have been spending a lot of time trying to figure out how this could happen, and we just talked about the polling. And, I mean, I think it'll be interesting to see as more information comes out exactly breaking down the demographics and the things that were going on in the election itself. But it's obviously really clear at this point that his victory was propelled by white working class people living in the Rust Belt primarily, or the northern parts of the United States. It was interesting, you know, I saw some numbers. He did much better among white working class voters than Romney did, correspondingly, Obama did better amongst these whites without college degrees than Clinton did.
Right.
And I mean, I think one of the reasons why like the election is so shocking, one of the things that I read, well, just the other night, it was Sunday night that I read it. I'd gotten around to reading the New Yorker editorial in which they expressed their support for Hillary Clinton. And maybe we can try to link to it once we get the show notes out for this. But, you know, to me, it was a super articulate, total takedown of why Donald Trump was uniquely unfit to be president. And what I took to be like a really sane kind of analysis of why Hillary Clinton, in fact, was going to be a great president and why she despite her reputation, isn't a particularly radical politician. She's a kind of a centrist Democrat. She's a kind of an idealist, but she's a pragmatic incrementalist idealist. And it sort of walked through all of her like very detailed policy proposals that were very sane to my mind anyways.
Right. I mean, right, in that to your mind they're sane. I'm agreeing with that part. Not that the policy proposals are sane.
And so to me, it was sort of like a definitive takedown, like a definitive rational analysis of you know, why everyone should vote for Clinton, and in some ways, why exactly Clinton was going to win. And I think the thing about all of that is that, you know, these, now how to describe them, I don't want to describe them as being media elites just because that comes with a certain kind of baggage. But in any case, like, they are elites. You and I are elites for that matter.
You know, I'm not paid that much, Ed. I don't know what you guys bring down in Westmont, but in terms of education, yeah.
You are a professor of political science with a PhD. You are an elite,
right? So we're in that, or at least I'm in that weird sort of in between where I have the education of an elite, but I live in rural Missouri and
So you
right? I mean,
that's right. You're a kind of an interesting case. I also am sort of an unusual elite. You know, my politics are liberal, and so I sort of fit in politically. But at the same time, I'm an evangelical Christian, so that makes me weird.
Right.
I mean, in some ways, that makes me doubly weird, right? Because I'm sort of neither completely at home in secular liberal elite circles nor completely at home in evangelical ones.
Right.
But I think there's just a way in which those cultural elites who are primarily liberal, they just didn't fully take seriously exactly how deep and visceral and real the antipathy was for vast swaths of the United States towards Hillary Clinton.
Right.
And they didn't think that because, I mean, many of them see, I mean, I would say many of them see Clinton for what she is. She is a centrist, incrementalist, pragmatic Democrat, even hawkish Democrat. But they just didn't fully appreciate that level of antipathy. And so none of these elites ever took seriously that the election was ever going to go in any other direction other than Clinton's, than a Clinton victory. So there's a huge cultural disconnect going on there. You're surprised. I'm surprised. the writers of The New Yorker are surprised.
Yeah, and again, it's I hate to keep going back to this, but it's also a geographic surprise. So I don't think I don't think anyone's surprised that there is that kind of mentality in Alabama.
Yeah.
But again, you know, Wisconsin, right? I mean, this is the home of modern liberalism. I mean, the New Left movement has at least one of its roots in Madison. You know, so the surprise is not just how many people there are, but where they are, right? And how influential they were on an election that again everyone thought had sort of wrapped up.
Yeah, you know, so this morning, and it's 8 a.m. We started recording 8 a.m. my time. I haven't had a chance to read much of the post-election scuttlebutt and what people are saying about this. But, I mean, it's really clear that this is a historic election for a lot of different reasons. And it seems like a lot of commentators are sort of reading this as being this deep illumination of cultural change in the United States. And I have to say that myself, I'm kind of torn about how significant, how we should read the significance of this election and the extent to which it sort of portends deep changes in American culture and American political society. Like, in a lot of ways, I think the reason she lost is because Clinton was a uniquely flawed candidate. Again, in ways in which elites, and especially liberal elites, never fully realized. But there was just a kind of a deep-seated antipathy that had been brewing since the 90s. It's not just that she is a uniquely hated American politician. It's like she's won, she's in first place, and there basically is no second place. Obama's in 10th place. And there's nobody in between them.
He is now. You know, in 2009, he wasn't.
I don't know. Even in the height of the anti-Obama frenzy, with all of its sort of xenophobia and lightly cloaked racism, I think Clinton is still enemy number one.
I mean, the charitable way to sort of spin that is... In some ways, Clinton is the Democratic version of Ted Cruz, in that for the last, 15 to 20 years, she has clearly had her eye on the White House. Like, she has, that is her goal, and that is what she has been moving towards. And I think there is still something in the American mentality that kicks back against that. I mean, maybe it's just a leftover from the 19th century when presidents weren't supposed to campaign at all. Mm-hmm. And, you know, saying publicly that you wanted to be president was the kiss of death. That's sort of the charitable spin that you could put on that. And I think there probably is some truth to that, right? I mean, the person who stands up and says consistently for a long time, I want to be the person in power, there is a reaction to that.
So, in some ways, part of me wants to say this doesn't necessarily reveal deep things about the election. What this reveals is that she was a uniquely flawed candidate. And I really think that virtually anybody else who Democrats could have put up. I mean, certainly Biden. I also think Sanders. But anybody else who they'd put up, I think would have won going away.
Yep, and I think the same is true on the other side. Any other Republican candidate, maybe excluding Ben Carson, the polls would have lined up with the results.
Yeah.
So, yeah, both parties picked the worst. That's getting into my thoughts. So I guess we should keep going with yours. Sorry, I keep jumping in on your reflections here.
Well, no, and then but. You know, Van Jones, so you were watching CNN last night, so you probably saw it when he said this, and this clip has been...
Oh, we had the sound off, so
I didn't
catch any of that.
Yeah, so there was this bit in which apparently he sort of got emotional at one point, and he described the election as white lash. Have you seen that?
I did actually see that's the one part I did see.
Right, and so Van Jones is the African-American commentator, political commentator on CNN. He worked for a spell in the Obama administration. But he on CNN said, this was a white lash. This was a white lash against the changing country. It was a white lash against the black president in part. And that's the part where the pain comes. And so, like, I think a lot of it is just the fact that she was a bad candidate. But the groundswell of, again, this white working class voice pouring out in greater number than they did for Romney, voting for Trump in a much greater number than they ever did, that gets at something interesting that hasn't happened before.
Right.
How about you? How did conventional wisdom get it so wrong?
Yeah, so I've got a because this election took so long, I actually had time to put some of these thoughts into order. So I've got kind of five different categories, and maybe I'll just run through these, and then if you want to go back and hit any of them specifically, we can. So we got sort of unanswered questions, right? Things that we don't know for sure. We've got conventional wisdom that has just been thrown out the door, conventional wisdom that is held true, and then things that we do know for sure, and then maybe at the end we'll talk about Christian responses, what we ought to think about this. But in terms of unanswered questions that we've still got, I don't know at this point that we can know whether this election is a confirmation of what Trump is for, or a negative on Hillary, or both, right? I don't think there's any way to know that, at least not at this point. Maybe we can sort of look at the congressional races and judge based on that, but even then, I would want to be a little cautious there. I don't think we can know what role the scandals played, right? Between the emails and the Trump tapes and so on. I don't know how much that necessarily affected voting. Again, that's sort of a wait and see kind of thing. As much as I hate to say it, we have to ask whether or not Jeff Sessions, Sarah Palin, and Chris Christie are visionaries. Are they just that much more in touch with the United States than the rest of us, which is not a question I ever thought I would have to ask. And I think that we have to ask, is this a sign that we're headed in a new direction politically in terms of the use of social media? The Trump campaign, as much as it was a campaign, was almost entirely in the air, right? I mean, it was almost entirely Twitter and Facebook and various other forms of social media rather than flyers and bumper stickers and TV commercials and all of the things that people have traditionally done, which is actually one of the sort of bits of conventional wisdom that we have to throw out, at least for this election. The old rule was whoever spends the most money wins, and Clinton outspent Trump ridiculous amounts. I don't know what the final numbers are, but I mean, it wasn't close.
You know, when you factor in all spending, though, I think it was pretty close.
So if you count down tickets, then yes.
Uh-huh.
But if you count just the money that is spent on the candidates themselves, mm-hmm. it's not. Trump didn't raise nearly as much as she did.
Yeah.
So it's...
I think the number that I saw, maybe that was total political spending.
The Republicans spent their money on senators, on House races, on governor races, yes. But again, that you also have to, the old rule is you have to spend it on the candidate also. So is this free stuff becoming more influential? And then another sort of unanswered thing, how did evangelicals vote? Based on sort of the final numbers we've got so far, it looks like they voted either for Trump or Clinton. The third parties did not benefit from the evangelical vote.
They broke hard for Trump.
I don't know that. I haven't seen the numbers on that yet.
I saw the numbers.
Okay, that's...
They were even... I think they were higher than Romney. They were insanely high.
Right. So, yeah, again, that's... Then we have the answer to that one. In terms of conventional wisdom that's been thrown out, again, the campaign spending, that's something that I actually look forward to the new round of textbooks for my Congress and presidency classes when they come out, because they're going to have to do something here, and I don't know what it's going to be. The balance between I'm trying to think of a way to say this that isn't too patently offensive. The old rule of things that you can or can't say on the campaign trail seems to have been broken. Now in some ways I think that's very good. The assault on political correctness, I have no problem with that. I think that will make our public discourse better. But the the assault on political correctness from Donald Trump became an assault on common human decency, and I think that makes our public discourse worse. So this idea that if you say certain things publicly, your campaign falls apart and you lose, again, that seems to be gone. You know, there was nothing that Donald Trump could not have said that you know people would not have voted for him. At least that seems to sort of reflect what we saw in the polls. So the rules of propriety seem to have been affected by this election. Again, we'll see if that holds down the road. Trump broke the blue wall, which is another big thing. Again, this idea that there are states that will just never vote for a Republican, that seems not to hold. He did not break California, but he broke the other big ones.
I don't know what California's numbers were like compared to previous elections, but it wasn't close to being close.
Right. And that's sort of the last conventional wisdom that's thrown out is that polls are good guides. That's the other thing that up until now we've been able to say, look, what the polls say is usually reflected actually at the voting booth, and this election it wasn't, possibly because of that social bias where people lie on the polls, again, along the lines of what we saw in England. In terms of conventional wisdom that's held true, so it's not like everything's gone, certainly most states voted the way we thought they would vote, right? I mean, most of the states were not surprises. We had an electoral college contest between our students to see who could predict it the closest. And for almost all of them, it comes down to, you know, four or five states, right? I mean, the vast majority of students got it pretty closely. The coattail effect seems to be holding true. So states where Trump won, Republicans tended to do well. States where Hillary won, Democrats tended to do well. That's not a universal truth, but it's mostly true. The idea of a realignment, which we don't need to get into the nuts and bolts of that. If we are in fact in a realignment, we're due for one. So again, that is part of conventional wisdom that seems to be holding up.
Maybe you should say what you mean exactly by realignment.
Yeah, so there's a theory in American politics that every 30 years or so, there's a shift in who's in power. So if you go back to, you know, 1800 and sort of map out every 30 years, you see, first one kind of Democrat, and then Andrew Jackson becomes president. Now it's another kind of Democrat. And then 30 years later, the Republicans come to power. And then 30 years after that, you have, sort of a different kind of Republican coming to power. And then 30 years after that, you have FDR. And then 30 years after that, you have Reagan. And then so we're due for a realignment, right? We're sort of set for a different kind of, political figure coming into office. It's actually been somewhat unusual the last couple of decades because we've had divided government, and people had sort of been saying, well, maybe this is our current realignment. And I don't follow these debates closely enough to be able to speak to that. I just know that we are sort of in that time frame where one ought to be happening. So if in fact the Republicans have won this election, and the next election, so the midterm election, from what I understand, most of the Senate seats that will be up will either be going back to the Republicans or will be seats that the Republicans should win and should take from the Democrats. So,
yeah, in 2 years, it's very uphill for Democrats.
I mean, we're looking at a potential 60-vote majority in the Senate for Republicans. So that, I mean, again, this theory of realignments, that's certainly a possibility. And I think we see the conventional wisdom that there's always a sense of discontent with whoever's in power. So in a sense, a Republican winning the presidency following 8 years of a Democrat in the White House, that matches the pattern that we've seen, for most of the 20th century. So if you're going strictly by parties and you sort of strip the names of the candidates away, again, that in and of itself is not terribly surprising.
Yeah. We, my Westmont colleague, Tom Connect, who studies American politics here, was giving a great talk to the faculty just about, right, so there are two ways of looking at presidential elections. One way is that it's all about fundamentals and it isn't about personalities at all. And, there are all of these various different predictors of the outcomes of political elections that just look at fundamentals. And if you look at the fundamentals, it was going to be that the Democrat was going to lose and the Republican was going to win.
Right.
And then the only time in which those predictions haven't held up have been outlier elections in which you had, like, an unusually weak candidate.
Right. So. Or you know, with someone like George H.W. Bush, where it's, you know, it's Reagan 3, right? I mean, no one's actually voting for him. They're voting for, you know, Ronald Reagan again.
Yeah. So I think the, when you look at fundamentals, Dukakis should have won that election. But the argument was that he didn't, because he was a uniquely flawed candidate.
Well, he let Willie Horton out of prison, Ed. Come on.
But, yeah, they're like, when you go back through history, they're sort of like three outlier elections.
Sorry, no. Candidates. I know only five of our listeners will get the Willie Horton reference.
Yeah, well, that's a good thing. Yeah, so, you know, one of the bits of conventional wisdom that I think is really stunning was that, you know, there was all of this hand-wringing about how the United States is becoming a majority-minority country, and that demographically, Republicans were, when you look at the nature of Republican support, it was just that they were struggling against a unavoidable demographic shift that was gonna make them a permanent minority party. And it's so interesting now, right? And there was all of that. There's been all of that hand wringing after the last two presidential elections, right? And all of those Republican voices that say, "Man, we've got to change. We've got to appeal to Hispanic voters and." All of those reformicon movements and figures within the Republican Party. And so we wake up on Wednesday morning and it's a total and complete shocking 180 in which now Republicans have control of the White House. They have control over both branches of the legislature. Within a couple months, they're going to have a majority on the Supreme Court.
Right.
And almost certainly by the end of Donald Trump's candidacy, it's going to be a supermajority.
Right.
You know?
With that said, I'll let you finish. Blends into these certainties we've got.
So we've completely flipped around from the Republicans are facing an inexorable battle against demographics to now being in a position in which they can exercise decisive, total control over the political process over the next 4 to 8 years, 10 years. I mean, then when you think about the Supreme Court, 20 years.
Yeah. So some of the things that we know for certain, right? We have these unanswered questions, the conventional wisdom stuff. A few things that are certain. It looks like, right? It looks like Hillary Clinton is going to win the popular vote. So she's up by a couple hundred thousand votes. They're still counting. Mm-hmm. So as of the time of this broadcast, it is not a certainty. But it looks like she is at 59,429,000, and Trump is at 59,240,000. So yes, you're right that Republicans have sort of swept the government. But there are still fewer of them. They did this despite there being, you know, more Democrats voting for Hillary Clinton, or more people voting for Hillary Clinton than voting for Donald Trump. So I think one of the things that we are certainly going to see out of this election is a repeat of 2000, you know, calling for the end of the Electoral College, calling for more direct democracy, a more sort of one-person, one-vote style system in the presidency, and accusations of Republican gerrymandering as the reason for these congressional wins. Obviously not with the Senate, because gerrymandering is irrelevant there, but in terms of the House, for sure, you'll see these charges. So I think that's probably a certainty that we're going to see. A few other certainties from this. We've elected the oldest president who's ever been elected.
Oh, is that true?
Yeah, Reagan was 68 or 69, I forget which, off the top of my head, when he went into his first term. Trump mm-hmm. is 70, so mm-hmm. he will turn 71 his first year in office.
He's the healthiest person on the planet, Coyle. So I mean,
his lifestyle. I mean, he's up at like 3 in the morning on Twitter. That can't be good for you. You know, I... That said, I suppose I should have checked that. That was something that I heard said at the party last night, and I didn't Google that. So if I'm wrong, and like Franklin Pierce was older, or you know some president that I don't know of, if they're older when they became went into office, you know, let us know on the Facebook page or the blog. Another certainty: third parties did affect the race. So New Mexico, Colorado, Utah, New Hampshire all would have gone other directions had it not been for third parties. But at least assuming that everyone who voted for you know whichever third party was had the highest votes would have gone for the underdog, right? So there's a big assumption there. But assuming that everyone who voted for Evan McMullen in Utah had voted for Hillary, it might have swung Utah the other way.
Yeah, I don't know that that's actually a sound assumption.
Well, again, but we don't know, so it's sort of a counterfactual. Assuming that everyone in New Mexico who voted for Johnson had voted for Trump, well, he would have won New Mexico. And again, same thing in Colorado and in New Hampshire. So there was an impact that the third parties had, but the big certainty here is that the two-party system really is alive and well, and it's entirely the fault of the third parties. Had the Libertarians put forward a non-Goober candidate, like they might actually have done, you know, much better than they did. They didn't break their 5%, so they're not going to get federal funding in the next election. There was an opportunity this election to have a robust third party sort of move forward, and they didn't pull it off. Which is sort of the last certainty, and I've certainly seen this in the state of Missouri, but I think we see it in the country as a whole. The idea of the outsider is really ascendant, right? The establishment is bad. We need someone from outside to come in and clean it up. We need this person who's untainted by politics. Never mind that being untainted means you are completely unprepared for it. We need someone who has never done anything in it before to come along and fix things. Someone who knows how to get stuff done because they're not part of the corrupt system. That seems to be the mentality of the nation, and I think that's been pretty much reflected in the election results, kind of up and down the spectrum. So that's what I've got that's certain. Anything to add on any of those, Ed? Any responses?
No. So.
Sorry. One more. The Never Trumpers had no impact on the election whatsoever, despite their very loud internet voices at places like National Review and American Conservative and so on. Mm-hmm. I guess I shouldn't say American Conservative because Pat Buchanan writes there also, and he is in the Trump camp. But by and large, they changed nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one of the interesting things about the election, so, I mean, the Democratic Party is obviously going to have to come together and have a big come-to-Jesus moment about what just happened and what lessons that they'll learn. And, I mean, I think one lesson is that it's just a huge mistake to commit yourself too early to, I mean, Hillary Clinton is such an establishment candidate that she was able to lock up the nomination before the nomination process even began. She's able to secure funding and basically by her monolithic presence sort of keep other people from competing in the process. And that was a huge mistake. And they never took seriously just how critically flawed a candidate she was.
Well, and it's not unreasonable given that it worked so well for them in the last election. I mean, I still think the superdelegates are a good idea. I mean, that's part of at least what you're talking about here. Mm-hmm. But they need to actually exercise judgment and not just go with, you know, the establishment candidate, right? I mean, there needs to be some actual critical thought and mm-hmm. surveying the landscape and so on. I think the reason they didn't is because in 2008 they just sort of went the way that the voters of the party went, and it worked for them. Right, I mean, they won two terms.
Well, yeah, that's certainly the case. I mean, she was the establishment candidate and the prohibitive favorite in 2008.
Right.
But I think the groundswell was just so great. I have a lot of friends who are Bernie supporters, and they're really frustrated at the Democratic Party. I mean, in some ways, I think the extent to which the DNC put their finger on the scale, I think, was marginal. Like, I just don't think that he wasn't Obama. He wasn't the Obama of 2016.
Yeah, and I think he would have been had the establishment not torpedo.
Really?
This
you
campaign.
Do think so?
I do. I think the fact that you had the superdelegates on her side so early certainly affected turnout at the polls, certainly affected the way people perceived his campaign. And also, of course, aside from the sort of behind-the-scenes hijinks that were going on.
Yeah, that stuff I think was totally inconsequential, actually. The superdelegates is another story. But did the superdelegates not line up behind her quite so quickly in 2008?
They didn't line up behind her until Obama had won the popular vote, then they jumped on board with him. I mean, there was more caution being exercised in 2008. Partially because he came out so well early on. And granted, I haven't looked at this in 8 years. So again, listeners, if I'm misremembering this stuff because I'm on, you know, a couple hours of sleep, please let us know. But yeah, from what I remember, they certainly had not committed, you know, before the primaries even started. But then again, the primaries in 2008, I feel like, started in January instead of later in the year. So I don't remember off the top of my head. Mm-hmm.
In any case, the Democratic Party is going to have to sort of try to make sense of. And it's so interesting. I mean, just in the last year, you know, there have been all of these books about highlighting the plight of the white working class, right? So there's J.D. Vance's book. There's that book from the LSU historian. Is it called White Trash?
I have no idea.
There's that book. There is the book by Arlie Hochschild. And so, like, you know, there was an advance of this increasing appreciation for the real hardships. So, I mean, I think insofar as that this election is culturally significant and even good in some ways, is that I think there's this realization that there are these large swaths of the American public who have been uniquely harmed by globalization over the last 20 years, and is hard hit as disadvantaged and impoverished as certain urban African American communities are, I think the situation isn't any better in a lot of small towns.
Yeah, and that's something we've been talking about a lot in class. Why did Trump resonate so well with people who demographically fit almost all of the same criteria, right? So the rural poor and the urban poor, aside from race and urban versus rural, like all of the other boxes you check, they're all going to be basically the same. I mean, everything from poverty to crime rates to, I mean, just up and down the board, they're functionally identical. Why is it that Trump resonated with, you know, rural America and not with urban America in the same way? Although, obviously, to some extent he did, because, you know, he won the election and he could not have done that without the cities, at least somewhat turning out. But I mean, I think the answer is the narrative, because the urban poor does tend to be minority, right? Largely minorities. The narrative of "Make America Great Again" doesn't sell, right? I mean, for African Americans especially, the idea that America was better in the past, that doesn't really hold water, because for them it wasn't, right? America is better now than it's ever been.
Not hold water. It's offensive.
Right? Yeah, you don't have the narrative of this used to be our country and it's been stolen from us, right? Things used to be better and now they're worse. Because African Americans know their own history, right? They know sort of the Jim Crow laws of the recent past and the slavery of the distant past. So the idea of, hey, let's go back to where we were in the 1950s or let's go back to where we were at the time of the founding, that doesn't work. Man, how'd we get on that?
Well, we were talking about the white working class.
Oh, right. So, yeah. So, again, why does that not translate also into the, you know, the African-American working class? I haven't seen the numbers on the demographic breakdown yet. So maybe it is different than I'm assuming. Maybe.
Yeah, you know, in the last election, Romney got 25% of the white no college education vote.
Right.
In this election, Trump got almost twice that.
Right. which is interesting given that Trump and Romney are in the same demographic themselves.
Well, that's right, but obviously, I mean, Romney is a man of the system just as much. I mean, he was a Bain consultant, yep. You know, just in some ways, just as much as Clinton was. You know, I recently read this review of a new book by Thomas Frank. I can't remember the title of his new book, but you know, Frank is a really interesting progressive voice because he's like super, super critical of the liberalism of the Clintons, and he's sort of always been a voice of like these Democratic elites are ignoring the heartland. It's become this very kind of professional meritocratic Ivy League progressivism, and not a kind of a populist progressivism. And so in his recent book, he was really sort of, is really prescient in a lot of ways because that's the narrative behind this election. You know, Clintonian progressivism that started in the 90s that really sort of embraced financial markets and globalization and all of that.
Yeah, there was an Atlantic article about that, I think. I think the name of it was something like how the Democratic Party lost the populist soul or lost its populist
heart. Yeah. Did he write that article?
I don't know, but it sounds like the book you're describing, so it wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah. You know, and the globalization thing, like it's a really tricky thing. So like economists will tell you, if we pass these trade agreements, we know that GDP is going to grow this amount. And they're right, you know? But the problem is that all of that, you know, who is that wealth accruing to? Well, it's accruing to technology people, and it's accruing to financial people. That is to say that it's accruing to highly educated, extremely wealthy, advantaged people. And who is it? Not only is it not accruing, but it's coming at the expense of white working class communities.
Well, any working class community in that sense, right? I mean that's there are few factories left in inner cities, and that is largely because of globalism, right? I mean that's kind of a direct result.
Yeah,
of that.
and that started in the 60s and 70s, so all of those benefits have accrued to this particular class of people, and they've also accrued to cities,
right?
Because
To suburbs, not even to cities, but to
I would say urban suburbs. So they've accrued to New York City,
right,
and the Northeast Corridor, and they've accrued to San Francisco and Silicon Valley. But and then when the wealth is going into cities, that can benefit people outside those classes because that generates service industries in cities.
Right.
But the problem in rural areas of the country, rural areas of the country are built around, you know, single big businesses of various different kinds, whether it's a plant or a mine or a factory. And those towns are too small to sustain the kind of service economy that you get in other kinds of places. And the kind of service economies that's going to sustain economic downturns, right?
Right.
Because people need to get their clothes cleaned and their cars worked on and their Starbucks, and they like to go to restaurants. But you know, in rural America, the plant closes and the town is devastated and there's nowhere to go. And so that's the reason why, you know, rural communities are particularly hard hit by globalization, even in a way that disadvantaged urban communities aren't.
So one of my first political memories, and it was odd. So I was 13 or 14. I guess I don't remember exactly how old I was, but a big group from my community in rural Montana got together and drove up to the Canadian border. So, you know, like an 8-hour drive across Montana to block off the border in protest over the NAFTA negotiations that were going on. Mm-hmm. And I distinctly remember having this weird disconnect. I mean, I was 13 or however old I was. I don't remember. I was in favor of it because it got me out of school, so I was okay with it from that perspective. But I do remember thinking, you know, these are people that I hear sitting around at the local co-op talking about sort of the glories of of capitalism and how much they loathe this, you know, socialist from Arkansas who just got himself elected president. And, you know, he comes out in favor of a treaty that's free trade driven, largely supported by, you know, Republicans, at least from what I remember. And yet we're protesting on the Canadian border. And it is that disconnect of, yeah, in general, we like capitalism, but this is going to devastate our agricultural community. Like we are not going to be able to compete with, you know, cattle and crops coming in from Mexico and Canada. Right. I mean, this, whatever the goods of capitalism may be, this is going to utterly obliterate our economic base. And they were right. I mean, the agricultural industry from the passing of NAFTA through September 11th was basically in the tank. In my particular community, raising pigs disappeared as an activity. It got to the point where if that was your primary source of income, you went out of business.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can do it now, but like, where do all the pigs and chickens come from? They come from really large scale.
Right. So no longer the family farms, right? I mean, yeah. And the large scale stuff you certainly can't do in the Mountain West where I was, and it's difficult to do in the Midwest. That's largely, it's not impossible, but that's largely a more industrialized operation, right? I mean, it's not the sort of thing you're going to have a lot of in the middle of Iowa or the middle of, you know, Minnesota.
Yeah, yeah. So all those pig farms in North Carolina and Tennessee, and
yeah, the chicken factories, right, in Virginia,
in Tennessee and Virginia.
Yeah, if you want to read more about this, so a great book that's unfortunately a little dated at this point. It's called "Hollowing Out the Middle." It's about the drain of industries from the rural communities to the cities and how devastating that is. I teach it in a state and local class. It's one of the few books that is both really interesting academically and really well written and sort of fun to read. These political scientists moved to Iowa and sort of embedded themselves in the community and lived there for a couple of years. And
oh, so it's like an ethnographic study of
it is I think Northeast Iowa or Northwest Iowa, something like that.
Yeah, I think this is one way in which, I mean, Trump's successful candidacy is a repudiation, really, of both parties. And this is a way in which both parties have both been on board with this trend towards economic globalization. And how both parties are going to respond now is a really interesting question. But I think... again, I do think that if there were any other candidate aside from Hillary Clinton, the outcome would have been very different. And there's a way in which I think we should sort of caution against reading too much into this election. But I think one thing that the election does show, and I would say like one good thing about the election is that it does highlight this plight of the rural white working class. You know, it's crazy. I was talking about this in class the other day, but there were these epidemiological studies that came out. Maybe it was the tail end of last year or early in this year. But you look at global life expectancy rates, and it's really amazing because you look all around the globe. You look at urban African American communities. You look at countries in Central and South America, in Southeast Asia, in Sub-Saharan Africa, you know, even though a lot of these places are living in really, really crushing poverty, nevertheless, when you look at life expectancy rates over the last 20 years, you know, it's all aligned with a positive slope. Everybody is living longer. And the really crazy striking thing is, it's that way literally around the globe, except for in one place, white rural communities. And there, when you look at the line, there is a definitive precipitous decline in life expectancy rates. And then when people first saw that, they thought, oh, well, you know, it must be a lot of, it's the diseases of the modern Western diet, right? So it's all heart disease and diabetes. And then they looked at the number more closely and they're like, no, it's not those things. The reason those life expectancy rates are declining is because rural white people are literally killing themselves. Like that decline in and life expectancy is totally attributed to alcoholism and drug use and suicide.
Right. So diet is part of it, but it's also drugs. It's also, you know, the various intoxicants. It's also, I mean, there's a spectrum of things. Now, part of that is also there are a lot fewer people, right? So one person commits suicide, the number spikes in a way that it doesn't in urban centers. Even the percentage, you know, goes up a little bit. But yeah, I mean, it is you're right to say that the life expectancies are dropping for reasons that don't always make sense if you don't take a sort of holistic picture of what's going on economically, culturally, and so on.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. And so, I mean, they feel culturally displaced because the world around them is changing. You know, I think that's a good thing in a lot of ways, but at the same time, like, I think we need to be sensitive towards the kinds of alienation that people experience. And then you look economically, again, the factory closes and the town is just gutted. And so, you know, here you have very conservative people who are proud and hardworking. And then they're stuck in these economically devastating circumstances. And then they do what anybody does when they're under those kinds of situations of stress and despair. They start medicating themselves with alcohol and drugs, you know?
And they hear the response from the liberal elites you were talking about earlier of, well, you deserve it for being, you know, the white conservative rural communities that you are. Mm-hmm. Bad things happen to you and too bad, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the world is changing and you have to change with it. And if you're suffering, well, that's all on you. So, you know, that pushback, right, it isn't really surprising. Again, what's surprising is how large it was.
Yeah. You know, you and I, I think we put it on our Facebook feed. There was that article in Cracked magazine. When I saw that, like, at first I didn't recognize it, but Cracked, right? Cracked is that magazine that both you and I read when we were teenage boys, right? It was sort of like, it's Mad Magazine, right?
It was the poor man's Mad Magazine.
Oh, is that right? Yeah, I think I was more of a Mad Magazine guy, but there you go. I'm a liberal elite.
Oh, no, I was mad, too, when I could afford it.
But Cracked, you know, so it was ridiculous in some ways that article appeared in Cracked. But there was this really stupendous article that was written there about the plight of the white working class. And it was sort of unnecessarily vulgar and provocative. It was written by this guy who's now like a fancy liberal media elite. Like, he runs their website, but he grew up in rural America, and he was like, you know, if I didn't leave, I'd be voting for Trump too. But he was precisely expressing that, like, it's the economic hardship, and then it's like the cultural disrespect, right? In which it seems like the whole system is tilted against them. Like, the only kind of ethnic slur that is still tolerated in polite company with no consequences whatsoever. It's like, you can make jokes about poor white trash, and you can make jokes about rural white meth users and their teeth, you know? And like, all of that is complicated for me. I mean, I think that's unacceptable. I'm also really super critical in some ways of the mores of those communities. But it really is the case that they've experienced a unique kind of hardship. You know, I mean, is their plight worse than that of disadvantaged African Americans living in urban communities, like, you know, in parts of North Baton Rouge, which I know well?
Right.
I don't know that they're worse, but it certainly ain't good.
Well, like you point out, though, it's in one sense there's no worse. They're both bad, but in another sense you still have sort of the establishment reaching out to those poor African American communities, right? Mm-hmm. Whether it's effective or not, at least the rhetoric is, we want to use the government to build up these urban centers, right? We want to.
We see you. We see your plight. We care about you. We respect you. We
right.
want to help you.
Nothing like that for the rural communities.
Even from Republicans.
Well, you maybe have the rhetoric, but then with the Republicans, of course, you have the, we will help you by getting the government off your back, right? We will help you by, which is something the American Conservative article talked about, where the Republican perspective is, the assistance we will offer you is we will, you know, enable you to go out and get a job and do all of these things through the wonders of capitalism and through the wonders of protecting your freedom of speech and freedom of religion, all of which I think are good things. But if you are out of work because the plant closed in your community, and you know you've got a family member who's doing drugs and you don't have the resources to get them help, or they're in prison because they've been doing drugs, or you know name the crisis of choice. The Republican message is less effective than it should be, right? Or than at least the Republicans think it should be. And the Democrats, of course, don't care. At least until this election, they haven't really cared.
Yeah.
Maybe excluding the Democrats from the more rural states.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, I do think that's. I mean, a lot of Clinton's, and maybe to a certain extent, this is influenced by the Sanders challenge in the primaries. But, like, a lot of her proposals were geared towards economic revitalization in the heartland. When you look specifically at the things.
But what does she mean by heartland? I mean, she means Chicago and Kansas City and St. Louis.
No, I mean, I don't think that's true. I mean,
maybe, like, Des Moines, right? I mean, maybe some of the towns of 100,000 or more. But it's not aimed at the family farmer with, you know, a wife and three kids, right? It's not in 100 acres. It's not aimed at, or at least the rhetoric is not specifically aimed at the people who again seem to have come out and voted for Trump.
Well, I can't remember off the top of my head what exactly her plan was for family farmers, but I bet you anything, man. If you go to her website, I bet you anything there's a policy proposal on that.
Oh, sure.
And I mean, I think she genuinely, I mean, I think she cares about that, actually. I think, but just, maybe not with the kind of priority in which it deserved.
Right.
So can I ask you where you think we are now and what the Trump administration is going to look like and how we proceed from here?
You know, I don't know. Trump, again, is such a wild card that I literally don't think there's any way to really predict. I will say that I will change my opinion of him if on, you know, January 21st he resigns. If he says, hey, look, I got what I wanted. I've got the line on my resume. I'm, you know, president now. I will never not have been president. I'm out. You know, you guys can – Mike Pence can take over. He's the one many of you voted for anyway. My opinion of him will go up significantly. Like I will adjust my view of him both as a person and as a candidate.
Do you think that there's any chance that that happens?
I don't think there's much of a chance of that happening. I think there's more of a chance that he might just sort of check out of government. He might be sort of chief of state who travels around and gives speeches and talks about how great things are going to be, and turns over the running of things to, you know, whoever his circle of advisors are. That I think is more possible, but of course we won't see that, right? I mean that would be insider information that we won't have from the public perspective. If the rumor that when he offered Kasich the vice presidency is true, that was his plan all along. I don't know. How about you? What do you predict from Trump?
You know, I really don't know. I mean, I think the odds of him dropping out are. That's not going
to
happen.
Oh, 100 to 1, right? But this is the election of 100 to 1.
Well, no, I would say that it's even less than 100 of less than the odds of him quitting. I think that is not in his temperament. Even if in some ways he's like, oh crap, now I got to do this awful job.
Right.
I think there's no chance that he quits. I mean, he might be a very disengaged kind of a president, but
right.
You know, whether he runs for a second term in 4 years, I think is something else. I mean, you know, last night I was in genuine despair. And when you look at, again, you know, going back to that Van Jones response last night on CNN, in which he was sort of like, you know, I'm getting a lot of messages and texts from friends in the African-American community, in the Muslim community, in in any kind of minority community, people are freaking out and they're scared, and you know, there are even legal Mexican immigrants who are sort of freaking out and are very worried about their personal safety, and it's a very dark time for progressives for a lot of different reasons. And then, you know, so all of that is going on around 8 or 9 my time. So the polls have closed and it's starting to trickle in and it's looking bad. And I'm freaking out. I am in full DEFCON 5. Wait, is DEFCON 5 bad or is DEFCON 1 bad?
Well, now I don't remember. I'm just DEFCON 5.
Yeah, I think 5 is bad. Anyways, whatever bad is, I was there. And I don't know. I'm kind of, I think I'm optimistic by disposition. And so I was sort of, you know, like, well, what is this going to look like? Is there any way that this could be good? And
well, I mean, certainly one thing that's good is we haven't seen, at least so far, massive civil unrest, right? The promised riots have not erupted anywhere, partially, I think, because the election went so long. You know, the results were announced again at whatever, two or three in the morning.
I mean, all the promised riots were coming from Trump supporters, right, in the event that he lost, not from progressives.
Oh, no. I've heard it on both sides.
Oh, like, really?
I've heard both directions, which, again, that might just be a difference in the media that we listen to. But maybe just because the results came out so, you know, so late at night, it's hard to go out and riot at 3 in the morning. But for whatever reason, we haven't seen that. So, again, as in 2000... Yeah, there's been this strange election, and yeah, the popular vote and the Electoral College don't match up. By and large, people seem to be handling it well, and that is encouraging. I still somewhat suspect the maturity of the American people, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But at least as far as that goes, people are handling it pretty well on both sides, right?
I think part of it is just the pure shock, you know.
Yeah, it may be.
I think the dominant emotion is surprise and despair, not necessarily anger. But, you know, it's like, you look at, I mean, all of the, what worried me most about Trump's presidency, right, is just the erraticness of it all. You just don't know, you don't really know what he's going to do. In a lot of ways, deep down, I don't think he's a political ideologue. I think deep down, he's probably more progressive than conservative in some ways.
He is certainly more progressive than conservative.
It's interesting to me that the one policy thing that he talked about was infrastructure in his speech mm-hmm. last night. That was the only thing that he talked about. It was infrastructure.
Which is so interesting because our infrastructure is mostly fine.
No, that is so not – Coyle, that is so not true.
Depending on what you mean by infrastructure, right? He talked about like roads and – I mean
– roads and bridges.
Yeah, you know, it's – have you ever not been able to get somewhere on a road?
Coyle, when you look at like studies by civil engineers, the amount of deferred repair necessary on bridges, it is like a crisis of massive proportions.
Yeah, I mean – so yes, there is work to be done, but we are not at a moment of collapse.
You know, it's so easy to sort of look at your surroundings and think, well, this is just fine.
Right.
But you look at studies of like the national state of the transportation system, bridges and highways, of the power grid, it's an epic need of repair. Like, there's so much deferred maintenance. The hole is so deep that, like, there's virtually no amount of spending that could get us back to the level at which we're maintaining our infrastructure at the rate at which we should. Right. And one interesting thing about both Trump and Clinton is that they both were sort of like, this is really, really important. And I think Trump dispositionally cares about that because he builds stuff. And he has this sort of weird... you know, like our infrastructure should be the best, you know? And I think he genuinely believes that. And so it's so interesting to me that like the only thing that he said last night was thank you to everybody except for Mike Pence. And,
who he did slip in right at the end, right? Yeah, right. Like as he's on his way
when
off
you
the
realize
stage.
That he had forgotten him, after he had said goodbye, right? When he was
the,
waving
the guy
to
who was standing next to him, he forgot, right?
And then he's and they said, "Oh, and Mike Pence." Thanks to Mike Pence, and you know, gave him a hug or whatever.
Which was actually, I thought that was kind of a humanizing moment, right? I mean,
it was totally telling.
Aren't I goofy? I forgot you. I mean, I can appreciate that a little bit.
I totally agree, and I think the correction was genuine. But I think it's also just super telling that, anyways.
Right.
So he thanked everybody. He talked about bringing the nation together, and he talked about infrastructure. And those were literally he didn't talk about the Supreme Court. He didn't talk about cutting taxes. He didn't talk about terrorism or conflict.
Abortion, the Second Amendment. I mean, all of the things that he had mentioned on the campaign.
And I think that's totally telling, and I think he genuinely cares about that. And so I'm like, well, good. That's a big issue, and infrastructure spending will put at least some people to work. It was interesting because, like, in some ways, he and Clinton were sort of dueling to see who was going to spend the most on infrastructure.
Right.
I think I should probably check this before I say that, but I think he even in his policy proposals, he was sort of like his proposals had more infrastructure spending. You know, how it was going to be funded is a different story, but it was sort of like the amount of infrastructure spent was telling. And so in some ways, you know, you look at all of the really, really disturbing rhetoric, right? The talk about immigrants, the talk about Muslims, the talk about women, and handicapped persons and the video and all of that. I think those are really, really revealing in a lot of ways. I don't think that Donald Trump is an out and out racist, right?
Oh, No. I don't think Donald Trump hates anybody. I mean, he loves himself than any emotion he has
he
for any other
lots
human being.
Of people, and he could hate anybody, but I don't know that it is on the basis of ethnicity. Let's say.
Oh yeah, I don't know that he hates anyone. It's just there are people that he is against because he thinks they've slighted him. But even then, they've slighted him, and if they apologize,
you know his view on women, that's disturbing to me. But anyways, I mean, the point that I'm getting at is that The things that worry me aren't the things that he says he's going to do. Actually, the things that worry me are the things that he hasn't said he's going to do, but you just never know, you know? So the wall, it's sort of like, you know, I just don't think a wall will be built and part of a wall will be built, but I just don't think. And, you know, we'll see what happens on immigration. To be honest with you, I don't think that very much is going to happen on immigration.
Yeah, I mean, we might go back to a sort of George W. Bush era immigration policy, like a actually trying to enforce some of the laws that are on the books rather than just letting everything slide
I think that's an inaccurate way to describe President Obama's immigration policy. And for what it's worth, Bush supported immigration reform.
He did.
Offered amnesty, right?
Well, he gave amnesty.
Yes, I mean, and that was totally shot down by Republicans.
Yep.
So there certainly isn't going to be the kind of comprehensive immigration reform that we need. And I think there are just real practical limits on what you can do on enforcement and building a wall.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, think
the wall thing is totally unworkable. There's
he'll build something, and he'll be out in Texas, and he's going to be standing by a digger. And they're going to start, and he's going to point to it, and they'll build hundreds of miles of walls, but it's not going to be significant.
And that's such a failure of, I mean, speaking sort of historically, having to build a wall to defend your borders is already a sign of failure of internal processes, right? I mean, I am in favor of securing our borders in such a way that protects the, you know, integrity of the nation. But if you have to use bricks and stone to try to do it, you've already lost. I mean, that's not the way to go about this sort of thing. And you just see historical example after historical example after historical example of that.
You can't keep people out with a wall.
Right.
But the thing that really worries me is sort of like just his erraticness, you know? And you just don't know what sort of whim is going to hit him or what kind of jealousy is going to motivate him or irrational hatred or anger. And so what he's going to do militarily or, you know, you just don't know. And I'm really worried about what's going to happen on climate change. I'm worried about what's going to happen in the Middle East, both in terms of increasing military action in Syria. In some ways, I'm kind of ambivalent about that. And I'm really confused on what to think about foreign policy in the Middle East. In some ways, I totally understand Obama's reticence to engage. In some ways, I think dispositionally, Hillary is definitely more hawkish. And I think in some ways I'm a little bit sympathetic with, but at the same time, it's just sort of like, you know, I just think it's kind of hopeless. But like, what we're going to do in Syria, what that's going to look like, our relationship, our diplomacy with, a conflict with Iran, the nuclear deal.
Right.
Which, you know, we never talked about that. I think it's flawed, but I think the consensus from foreign policy professionals is that it was a flawed deal, but better than the status quo. And so who knows what happens with that? Who knows what happens with North Korea? And just the volatility of all of those situations, I really worry about that. And I worry tremendously about the environment. Because I think that I've been thinking about this very recently. And I really think that global warming is an existential moral threat. And the extent to which he is going to sort of take apart every sort of commitment that the Obama administration has had to try to ameliorate that and to encourage a green energy industries.
I am quite happy to go through life ignoring existential threats. Like if it were an actual threat, we could talk. But if you're saying it's just an existential threat, that doesn't.
Look, I mean, it's an existential threat, and that doesn't mean an existential threat going into the future. If you go to Miami, literally, there are parts of Miami that flood when it rains because the water levels in Miami Bay, when there's a high tide, go above the level of the storm drains. And now there are literally parts of Miami that flood regularly every time it rains that are like under 5 feet of water. And people in Miami are freaking out.
Right, which we should do. We should do a global warming episode at some point, which will mean that I'll have to read up on it.
I think Christian skepticism about global warming is the craziest thing.
Oh yeah, I'm skeptic may not be the right word. Apathetic is probably the right word.
Yeah, and so you know, apathy I understand, but I think,
I mean, do we really need Miami?
Well, a lot of people in Miami just voted for your new president of the United States, but you know. Tornadoes in the heartland because of more extreme weather. Anywhere on the coast, it's, you know, hurricanes in the Gulf, drought in my part of the country and in lots of parts of the country. Like, it's not just 50 years in the future. Like, it is here and now. So, you know, and then I also here's another kind of a fear that I have that, like, he sort of made all of these promises. And, you know, part of me thinks that he's going to eventually be sort of hemmed in by the inherent conservatism. And I don't sort of mean ideological conservatism, but I just sort of mean the conservatism of federal governmental institutions. And he's going to have to hire political hands and politicians to run these various different things. And so I just think it's like, in some ways, it's inherently difficult even for a Republican to do radical things in government. You know, what the Justice Department is going to look like with Attorney General Giuliani, or, you know, whatever department Chris Christie ends up running. Like, that's all a little terrifying to me. But in some ways, like, when his policy proposal and extravagant promises ultimately fail, like, what's going to happen next? And then I think all of those people who swept Trump into power are going to go, are going to see, like, even this guy failed us. And they're going to go to the next guy, and the next guy is going to, is not going to only say politically incorrect things in the way that Trump does. He's going to be, you know, he's going to be a racist. And,
well, and again, the more optimistic spin on all of that from a conservative point of view is, yeah, Donald Trump is the president, which means Hillary Clinton is not. And this, I think I've said this on the podcast before. If not, I should have. We have the best leadership in Congress that we've had in my lifetime, excluding, you know, since I've been paying attention to politics, probably the way to say that, since the days of Tip O'Neill. I mean, this is in terms of a combination of competence, virtue, understanding how the system works, being willing to play by the rules, all of the things that go into making someone a great speaker or a great Senate majority leader. So, yes, Trump is in the White House, but it may very well be the case that for the first time in a long time, Congress gets a budget put together before the White House does. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised to see that happen just because Trump has to, you know, set up the White House, and I don't know that he knows how to do that. So it may be that we start seeing a congressional resurgence of leadership that we haven't seen for a while, in part because Republicans control it, and in part because we do have great leadership on that side. So as much as I agree with a lot of what you said about Trump and him personally, there's still a Paul Ryan and a Mitch McConnell to deal with, and they are both highly competent and very, very good public servants. So,
well, so I'll say this. You have a higher view of Mitch McConnell's virtue than I do. And while I think Paul Ryan is a decent fellow, his public policy proposals worry me tremendously. And so I, you know, I worry about all of that stuff, you know. So Obamacare is going to be dismantled,
which does not worry me at all.
So we could have a debate about that.
We should.
A lot to say about healthcare, but right now rates of the uninsured are at historic lows.
Yeah, what's going to happen to rates again this month, Ed?
That's
20 to 50% increases across the board.
That I think is totally confused. I don't know if now is the time to talk.
Yeah, we shouldn't get into this now.
But the across the board rate increases. That's not across the board. That is for premiums in certain states, especially states that haven't supported Obamacare proposals. And the reason why those rates are unusually high is because they were creating a market from scratch and they failed. And it's really hard to set a premium for a market that doesn't exist. And there was just a lot of pent-up demand from people who didn't have medical insurance. And so when they finally got medical insurance, they used it a lot more than people anticipated. So what eventually was going to happen is that they underestimated the amount of usage of medical services in the first couple years. And so rates kicked up. But eventually that pent-up demand would exhaust itself and rates would come back down. But overall healthcare costs have been climbing at a rate lower than they were before Obamacare. And when people talk about the rates of those premiums, they totally fail to appreciate the real drivers for what was driving that.
But it's not as much worse as people think it is.
A far higher percentage of Americans have health insurance now.
Which assumes a lot of things like health insurance is a good. I mean,
we'll talk about that.
Yeah, we should not go down that.
States that supported Obamacare, their healthcare situations are good, and when you look at across the board costs of medical use in the United States, they are down from where they were before.
Oh, sure, before and states that opposed it were punished. I mean, that's, you know, perfectly.
They weren't punished at all. They resisted. They were offered free Medicaid that they rejected. Louisiana was a state that did that. And they weren't punished. I mean, they weren't punished at all. There was money there for the taking, and they said no, and they said, we're not going to set up healthcare exchanges. You do it. States that supported it are doing just fine.
But yeah, so we, again, that's a black hole we shouldn't fall down right now.
I was just going to say this. There are going to be lots of people who have health care now who are suffering from chronic diseases, who just discovered that they have cancer, and they're going to lose their health insurance. And it's going to be a catastrophe for them.
Well, let's move on. Again, I don't want to get hung up, man. I'm on a limited schedule here.
So I know that you wanted to talk about where Christians are in the midst of all of this and how Christians should make sense of our present political moment.
Yeah, and two other quick observations from last night. I don't know if you got this or not. At about 10:50 our time, so I guess that would have been like 8:50 your time, did you have the emergency broadcast interruption?
I didn't
see that, no. So we had, and this was on all of the stations, we had the emergency broadcast screen come up, issued for the following areas, the United States, scheduled for 1 p.m., which it was interesting. I mean, it was 10:50 at night, and we have this 1 p.m. emergency broadcast that, from our perspective, was, it said it was for the entire country. It lasted, all of 30 seconds. It was nothing, but it was still kind of an odd occurrence that I thought was something I had not seen before in the middle of a presidential election, election results. And then I'm sure you've heard the Canadian immigration website crashed last night.
Yes, yeah.
Which is also pretty...
I think the New Zealand tourism website also crashed.
Yes. We should talk about New Zealand at some point. They have interesting immigration laws.
New Zealand is like paradise, man.
Yeah, that's why they don't let anyone move there.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they basically say you can't move here. That's pretty much the set rule. So I think one sort of big thing, in retrospect, we should not have been surprised by either the candidates or the outcome. In a sense, we have an election that is a good reflection of the United States. So we have the, corrupt crony establishment candidate running against a YouTube comment. And I mean, I think that probably is a fair way to describe sort of the American people. So looking back, maybe it's less surprising than I was, than I felt 9 months ago or than I felt when we did our convention episodes. So in retrospect, maybe I should have seen more of this coming, but of course that's in retrospect. And I think that's all I had out of the results itself. Did you want to say anything about the sort of what all of this means for us as Christians, or do you want me to cover that?
I mean, this is something that I sort of personally wrestle with. There are lots of Christians who are extremely enthusiastic. And as you mentioned up front, I mean, there's a way in which, like, his election is good for me in some ways. I think that as a matter of justice, the United States should grant certain kinds of rights and liberties to people, which ultimately are going to have the effect of putting the pinch on people like me. But I think that as a matter of justice, like, we should do that. So in a certain kind of way, very personally, like, things are fine. Maybe my tax rates are going to go down, and I probably don't earn enough for my tax rates to go down.
Yeah, I don't imagine my tax rates will be unaffected by this.
So in a weird kind of way, it's like, it's just fine for me. It doesn't affect me. But like, I think a lot of the rhetoric, I think, was mere rhetoric, and thumbing, and in effect, the politically incorrect language is a big middle finger to the system. And I don't think that he's just... Lots of racists were really enthusiastic about his campaign. But that's a distinct... And that's worrisome, but that's a distinct minority. I don't think that he himself is.
And again, I don't mind the deconstruction of politically correct language. That's fine. That's a good. But doing it by being indecent, that's not a good, right? So what will the net result of this be? Again, I don't know. In a world where Donald Trump has won the presidency, I don't know what the candidates will look like in 2004. Will the Democrats find someone who will out-Trump Trump? If Trump decides not to run again, or if for health reasons he can't run again, will the Republicans try to find someone else again? I don't know. I don't know what that's going to look like. From a Christian perspective, I mean, I think some of it's straightforward, right? Whoever is in charge, we are to pray for the political leadership, so that hasn't changed. One caution that I would have for Christians is not to retrench in old patterns of blending church and state. I think we've seen a lot of positive theological development and a lot of good ways of thinking about government come out in the past few months as sort of evangelical Christians have thought they were going to lose. I think that that's all good stuff. And in some ways, a real test is having won the election, can we hold on to or can we cling to those good ideas that were coming out? You know, the idea that America is not God's country was amongst evangelicals more popular than it had been in a really long time in the last few months. I think that's a good thing. And I think just because the other side didn't win isn't actually a good enough reason to go back to it, aside from, you know, all of the biblical reasons. Like we said in the...
Sorry, just to clarify, what's a good thing? That we are, that we think that we are God's country?
No. So that separation of the evangelical church from the Republican political establishment and from this narrative of America as, you know, God's people, right? The sort of David Barton view of the world. That separation that was starting to happen in a pre-election evangelical world, I think was very good. And I hope that continues. I hope people don't say, oh, thank God Trump won. Now I can go back to thinking the United States is God's blessed nation, right? The United States is the new Israel. There's a great post on the Gospel Coalition about that by Jonathan Lehman basically some of the things that we've said on this podcast before. The most important thing is still whoever won the election. The most important thing is still our local church, right? That should still be the institution that you and I and all Christians are most invested in, regardless of who is president, regardless of who won the election. That's what matters most. And I sincerely hope evangelicals don't backslide on this. I hope we don't fall back into that older mindset. That's sort of the big thing I've got. Don't look at Trump as the savior who restores all of the things that we had in the past. Whether or not he makes America great again should be largely irrelevant. What should matter is our unity in the gospel in the local institution. Our faithful preaching the message of salvation and forgiveness and reconciliation to God through the cross to each other and to the watching world again. Hopefully this won't weaken our witness as a church.
I know that you, Coyle, need to run off to class presently. We should probably try to wrap this up and get this episode out. So let me just thank everyone for listening to the City of Man podcast. It is doubtlessly going to be the case that we will spend the next few weeks continuing to dissect the election and its aftermath and what it means for our country and for us as Christians. We are proud members of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. I imagine that the other podcasts in the family will also be visiting this topic. Please visit christianhumanist.org to learn more about our show and all the other shows in the network. We'd be really grateful to see your comments and questions, and maybe the best way to get in touch with us is by visiting our Facebook page. Like our Facebook page. It is just facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast, or you can email us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. And now you, Coyle, sort of asked me for my sort of theological take on things, and so I will close this with a poem that my wife showed me, and this is a poem by David White, and it's called Loaves and Fishes. This is not the age of information. This is not the age of information. Forget the news and the radio and the blurred screen. This is the time of loaves and fishes. People are hungry, and one good word is bread for 1,000. And as always, maybe especially these days, render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is
Thanks.
Your land, and this land is my land. From the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway.